Bonjour, bonjour, and welcome to another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com, the No Fluff Actionable Marketing Podcast for marketers, marketing consultants, founders, and tech people who are just sick of shady, aggressive marketing. I'm your host, Louis Grenier. In today's episode, you'll learn how to build a successful content marketing program without silver bullets or shitty growth hacks. My guest today is the director of content at Intercom. You probably have heard of this company before. They are a customer messaging platform. My guest is a former journalist and editor. Intercom is now 8 years old, almost 9 years old pretty soon. They have like 30,000 plus paying customers globally. I mean, they raise a ton of funding. They have offices everywhere. And what's really interesting about my guest is that, as I said, he's a former journalist, editor. He has more than 20 years experience covering tech, business. He's been mentioned in a lot of publication, and he now leads the team who produce Intercom's blog, podcast, books, social media, et cetera, et cetera. So super happy to have you, John Collins, on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Louis. Delighted to be here. I was listening to that intro going, who is this smart, clever guy who's going to be on? So I don't recognize him.
Yeah, I mean, to be, as I was saying just before we started to record this episode, I've seen your face popped up a lot online, you know, and that's probably testament to the good work you've been putting as Intercom, but also as you. I think you've led the way in a few ways in terms of content marketing in the recent years. And it's good to have you on the show. So everyone's talking about content marketing nowadays, right? Everyone, every single company seems to say we need to do content. And frankly, you know, from my side, who follows marketing a lot and talk to people a lot, it feels almost like very redundant. And it feels almost like, why are we waking up just now or in the last few years about the power of content, while the smartest companies in the world seem to have done that for almost ever? So I want to hear more from you. Like, why do you feel companies just are kind of slowly waking up to the power of actually helping people through content?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You said, you know, companies are waking up to doing content. And actually, that always kind of worries me. And I think it's a bit of a tell when, you know, people contact me and like they want to come and pick my brains or the team's brains about how we've achieved what we've achieved with content marketing at Intercom. Because they'll say, we want to do content. It's almost this idea of they want to check a box. They want to tick a box. If someone comes to me and says, we want to invest in content, we want to build a content team, I'm like all ears. But when people say they want to do content, I'm always a little bit suspicious, because I really think, you know, it indicates this attitude of, well, we just tick the box. Like, you know, hey, HubSpot did it. You know, it worked for them. It can work for us. I mean, I was quite lucky at Intercom. When I joined Intercom, the company was nearly 2.5 years old. And two of the founders, Owen, the CEO, and Des Trainer, the chief strategy officer, really, really had that vision and belief in what content could do for the company. And Des didn't just sort of have that belief, but he actually, you know, he walked the walk as well as talked the talk, because he actually wrote the first 93 of 100 blog posts on the Intercom blog before I arrived on the scene. And I think that's what you need. You need a client or a company, if you're going to go in-house, or, you know, who really is going to invest in content. And it's tough and it's not glamorous work. And I think that's probably why we hear a lot of people talking about content, but, you know, to actually embrace it fully, more than maybe to sort of like, you know, launch a blog and it runs for like, you know, 6 or 8 weeks and they run out of ideas, or, you know, like we see lots of failed experiments. But like the problem with content is it's a big investment. You know, you have to invest in people and their time. It doesn't, you know, deliver benefits straight away. It's not like just turning on a campaign on, you know, Google Display Network or something. But the great thing about it is it's slower to start, but it pays off in dividends. You know, if we stopped publishing on the Intercom blog today, you know, we would still get 80% of the traffic, you know, in a quarter's time, because it, you know, people are still going to find that through search. We could still, you know, promote that stuff through social. It's still there to be browsed on our blog. And, you know, assuming you're creating the right kind of content, it'll pay off in spades for a long, long time.
Right. And before going to this, you know, step by step on how to do that in your company, let's take a step back and try to understand from your perspective, why is content marketing such a fundamental element of marketing nowadays? Even though, as I said before, like a company from my hometown, actually Michelin, the tires, you know, did some form of content marketing more than 100 years ago with their Michelin guide. Why is it such a fundamental element of today's marketing?
I think it's a reflection of maybe the broader media landscape, that, you know, there's some great, like, you know, tier one media out there, you know, like the New York Times and the Washington Post and whoever of this world. But like, there's very few, you know, there used to be really strong, for every industry and every sector, there used to be a really strong trade press, which was actually, you know, properly reporting and writing quality content. And that's largely gone now. And, you know, people can actually create their own content online and share it. And the companies are successful at it. It's not promotional content. It's not PR. They're not just talking about themselves. They're like, you know, entering into discussions in their industry or, you know, debates. And that's all the stuff I think that a trade press and would have served in the past. And I think it's driven, you know, I suppose then as well, the whole inbound model. And that's been so successful for so many companies. It definitely feels like something that you can, you know, you literally, if you're a startup, you know, day one, you can start a blog, you can start a podcast. You know, it's something that everyone can do. Everyone can write. And that's kind of dangerous as well. I mean, we can get into that as well. But, you know, everyone can put words down. And so I think people feel like, oh, we can totally do this. The issue, of course, then becomes one of quality, that everyone can create some kind of blog or some kind of publication or some kind of podcast, but can they do it well? And will what they do actually stand out and be heard? That's a real challenge.
So there's a lower barrier of entry, right? I mean, anyone, as you said, can write. It seemed, I don't know if it's a consequence or the cause, but as you said, trade press and all of that are almost nowhere to be seen. I mean, in terms of tech and startup and whatnot, we don't see that happening. So companies have kind of filled the gap. And the internet as well started to give the power to companies and individuals to be able to publish stuff themselves. And you don't have to be a journalist to actually publish content and be seen by people, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're putting out a whole layer of middlemen who, you know, may not understand your industry as well as you do. You know, I think it's this direct connection that you can have with readers or you know, with listeners, that's really, really attractive. I mean, for us at Intercom, it's been one of the great ways to really sort of get to know our customers and like what resonates with them and what problems they're struggling with, and then like what jobs Intercom can help them solve with. I mean, content has been a part of that, and events and getting out and meeting customers has been a big part of that from the early days. It was kind of like, as we say, it was the kind of marketing we were doing before anyone actually had marketing in their job title. We were doing content marketing.
So you said something super interesting a few minutes ago that I want to come back to, and I suspect this could be probably step one of the methodology you're going to lay out for us in the next few minutes. Mm-hmm. Talked about mindset, you know, the mindset of the founders, the mindset of the people at the very start of the company who knew that they wanted to help people out there with good content, you know, whether it's like blog articles and whatever. I'm curious, do you feel the first step towards building a successful like content program in your company, to build and invest in it, do you feel like this is a must to actually have the top, you know, the leadership in your company to believe in content in the first place?
I think it makes a massive, massive difference. And I would struggle personally to run a content operation at a company that didn't have that, because, you know, one of the things I always caution against is, you know, you see a lot of companies and they kind of look at content the way people like would have looked at a company newsletter, in that it's almost like, hey, let's not do anything too controversial. Let's not rock the boat. Like the CEO is going to like sign off on content, even though he probably isn't creating the content. It's that classic sort of, you know, play it safe model, and not really understanding, I think, what you can get from content and how actually, you know, being opinionated and sort of, you know, getting your opinions out into the world is a great way to grab attention when you're a small company. And I think something else like that the founders at Intercom, Owen and Des and Kieran and David, really felt was that actually blogging and writing things down was a great way for them to sort of like just synthesize what they'd learned. It was a really great way to sort of process like, hey, you know, we've gone through this big project and like we learned this thing, but then actually sitting down to write a blog post about it, for instance, was just a really, really great way to go, oh, like that's actually what we learned and that's what we can repeat and that's what we can do next. And I think it's that kind of content that's really resonated. Certainly in the early days at Intercom, because, you know, we were selling our product to a lot of startup folks and the guys were being very open about the things they had learned as startup founders.
Yeah, and something I wanted to kind of challenge you on a bit, because that might not be a case for every company, everyone listening to this podcast, is that you had the benefit from the start to be able to share your learning as a startup, and yet you're also selling to startups, right? So the stuff you were learning, even though it wasn't directly related to the product, were still relevant to the market you were trying to attract. Are there scenarios where, before we go into this kind of step-by-step together, is there a scenario where you would see that not happening and you sharing as a company your learnings that wouldn't be relevant to the market you're trying to attract?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, listen, there's obviously cases where content is not just going to be a good marketing strategy. You know, if you make like, widgets or whatever, which are like pretty undifferentiated, you know, it's all about price. You know, that's your marketing is you're going to compete on pricing and writing about like how you build your widgets or how your widgets are like much better quality than the competitions is probably not going to move the needle for you. So I think, you know, it really does depend on the sector. But equally, I would say that, you know, everyone is an expert. Like on some, if you've set up a company and you're selling a product or a service, you know, you have some knowledge that like you are sharing with your customers. You know, even if you're that classic startup where you're just like, you've identified a problem and you're learning yourself about like how to solve that problem and what you can contribute, like just having the balls to like openly share that and, you know, get it out and get a discussion going. That's huge in itself. Even if you're just willing to actually like, you know, write about that, you know, talk about it on air in a podcast, that will be huge. And I think it's just a great opportunity to sort of engage your customers and actually get like, even look at it as customer research.
So let's talk about how to set up a successful content program, right? And as you mentioned mm-hmm. before, a few minutes ago, folks would reach out to you and ask those questions. So you are aware yeah. and you know how to answer this question because you probably get that question quite a lot. So first, let's lay the foundations. You started to talk about this. Yeah. In what situation do you feel from your experience, content marketing, how can it be a good investment? In what situation is it a good investment to potentially put money towards, and in what situation is it not?
Listen, you know, as I say, if you feel and you know that like having some opinions or sharing some knowledge with your customers is going to resonate with them. And I think like definitely the B2B space is great for that kind of deeper sort of like standard kind of almost blog playbook where that's the kind of content you're going to create. And like maybe that blog is nowadays a podcast because like, you know, I definitely think we've passed peak blog. You know, people like to listen to podcasts because they can listen to them anywhere. You can't always read a longer blog post. So I think that's a massive scenario that, you know, says to you, yes, this is going to be worth investing in. I think in B2C, there's definitely content, but it's maybe a different kind of content. You know, B2C, massive investment in Instagram these days. You know, if you don't have like a cool Instagram account as a B2C brand, you're pretty dead in the water. As I say, I think it's really just those more undifferentiated products that like maybe where you're just purely talking about price and, you know, no one really cares about how it's built or like there's no real story around it. I think that's where you're like, you know, right. You're in a challenge and forget about content marketing, really.
Let's take the example of a B2B company that have, mm-hmm. you know, tried before maybe to do content, as you said, they realized they didn't take it yeah. The right way. But this time they want to invest in it for the long term. They understand the power it can have long term. What do you advise them to do step by step? And if you want to ask me a question about this fictional example, like to have it more narrow so you can find better answer, let me know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I think like, first off, I say, you know, there's no sort of silver bullets or quick hacks. I Googled it once, you know, content marketing hacks, the, like, you know, 56 million results or something. Like, I think on one hand, you know, you look at brands like Tesla or, I don't know, like even Patagonia in the consumer space, even like House, you know, the brand who like look after sort of selling interior design products and furnishings for your home and stuff. Like, go to their homepages and like Tesla, it's like the car is there, but actually it's almost this lifestyle. It's selling these beautiful, beautiful high-end images of like, you know, Californian homes. You know, go to Patagonia, their homepage, you'll see like these amazing pictures from the 60s about with one of their founders, you know, who's like a famous climber who created his own, he's written a book and, you know, he created Patagonia to solve his own problems. And then even like something like House, it's just these beautiful images of houses. And like the whole thing is product placement. You can click through and like find out who the, you know, interior designer is or what the products are. And then, you know, and particularly in the B2B space, you Google content marketing hacks and you literally have, you know, in comparison to all this beautiful content that's competing for our attention, you have these literally shitty hacks of like how you're going to drive, you know, how you're going to drive traffic. You know, to talk about things like skyscraper methods of like, you know, just being, you know, 2% better than your competitors. Like, it's just, it's really very kind of like snake oil salesman kind of stuff.
Why don't you like, sorry to interrupt, but I'm curious now. Why don't you like the skyscraper technique from Brian Dean, for example?
Well, I think it's been done to death. I would think like Google algorithm is sophisticated enough now that like for most competitive keywords, it's not really going to work. I mean, you're literally just trying to be about like a minimum of 1% better than your competitor's article. I'd suggest that like, you know, the effort that you put into that, why don't you just come up with something that actually blows your competition out of the water, full stop. I think particularly SEO driven content, it's more competitive. I think Google's getting more sophisticated. And so I would actually say that like, look around you and look at the stuff that you engage with. And that like, you know, I'm a big believer in that, like marketing is not just data. It's about like, you know, creating some kind of emotion, some kind of feeling in people, even for B2B products. Like we talk at Intercom and our marketing team about how, like, you know, is there a spark in what we're doing in like any particular campaign or piece of content we're producing? And I think it's really, really important to look around, see that stuff that you do resonate with, those brands I mentioned, and go, hey, you know, I'm like, even if I'm creating B2B content, I should be focusing on the quality content, not the hacks. Like I think people are overly focusing when it comes to content marketing on the marketing piece, and there's very little about how do you create good content. And you have to create good content. Like the dirty, guilty secret of content marketing is there are all these consultants out there who come along, create blogs and other like properties for companies, set them up for them, and like they don't perform. They get very minimal traffic. But you know, they've done the thing, they've set up the thing, and they get paid and off they go. But like if you want your content to be consumed, to stand out, you've got to start with like creating the highest quality content you can first, and don't start with the hacks.
Yeah, I concur with that. Now, I know my listeners by heart. You know, that's probably one of the things about marketing. You need to know your people quite a lot. And I'm lucky enough to have a lot of good listeners who contact me, give me feedback. I know that at this stage, when you said, you know, you just need to create good content that blow the competition out of the water, they are asking, how the fuck are you supposed to do that? Like, how do you do it? How do you notice whether there's a spark in your content? So let's go through that now, like in detail. How do you advise folks to do this? Like, you know, they're in front of their computer, they're probably listening to this on their way home or in the gym, and they say, yeah, that's all well and good. I completely get you, John. I'm going to do the same, but where do I start? Yeah. You know, I have this empty page in front of me.
Sure. I mean, there's several sort of tips I would give to people. Like, first off, really simple one, like, what are the three most controversial things you believe about your sector, or your industry? What are the three things you believe that like other people don't in your industry? Like, and presumably, particularly I think for startups, that tends to be like why people actually decided, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to set up this company. If you can figure out like what those views are, like what those things are that make you stand out from the crowd, like start to write about them, start to discuss them, because that's what people are interested in. Like there is too much safe content out there that is, you know, everyone else in the industry, no one disagrees with it. If no one disagrees with it, you shouldn't write about it. I mean, you at the very least just move on the debate in your industry, even just a small piece, you know. But that small piece should be like what's unique and what you're bringing to the table. The other thing I would say is, you know, very much think about like writing for humans. You know, brainstorm a bunch of ideas on a whiteboard, absolutely. But like humans are going to buy your product at the end of the day, not the algorithms. You know, the algorithms will deliver a certain amount of traffic to you. But I think if you like think about like, is this an article that I would want to read? Is this an article that like, you know, my partner would want to read or potential customer? You know, actually have real humans in mind when you're creating content, I think is huge if you're going to go down this route of trying to create quality content first. I think you can add SEO at a, you know, later point. But if you start off with SEO, I don't think you're not going to create quality content. You're going to create, I call it happy meal content. Looks good. You think it's going to be really satisfying, but 15 minutes after you consume it, you're hungry again.
You're hungry again, and yeah, there might be an accident happening along the way as well. So yeah, I don't digest Happy Meals very well, so I stop going there. So let's go to step one, right? So you have to figure out the two to three things that you believe that most people don't, right? Now, let's say you are a content marketer hired in the company, you're not a founder, or let's say you are a content marketing freelancer, you're a copywriter. How do you figure that out? Like, do you interview the CEO to extract that from them? How do you like to figure out the things that actually make them stand out that most people would disagree with?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I do. Like, go and talk to people around the company if you're coming in, whether it's like founder, the CEO, you know, the people actually building the product, like then, yeah, get out and actually meet some people who are customers. Whether, like, I found trade shows were amazing. I used to like stand on, you know, be on the Intercom stand when it, like, you know, at big conferences like Web Summit when during the first year I was there. And it was really just a great way to meet and eyeball customers. We still have a thing called Customer Day at Intercom where you literally get into the inbox. Like, we use Intercom, obviously, to run Intercom, and we have a customer support product. You get into the inbox and start answering customer support. Like, you see what kind of customer support questions are coming in, and you get to answer some of the easier ones. Back in the day, I actually was, you know, I was on the customer success team at Intercom when I joined first, because Des ran that team and I needed to report to him. So I used to regularly be in the inbox answering customers' questions. And that was an amazing way to go, oh, these are who our people are. And I think once you then know who those readers are, you can do so much more, and you can really start to think about like what kind of things are going to resonate with them.
You know, this is such a simple advice, yet you and me, we both know that this is very rare to hear, you know, marketers, content marketers, people in general, you know, actually yep. go out of their way to talk to their customers, to meet their customer face to face, to talk to their CEO, even to understand the story of the company. It's rare because we are a bit safe, I think, as marketers nowadays. We sit behind Google Analytics every day. We look at our SEO tool and we feel we understand our audience. Well, actually, we don't, right? And I have plenty of example in my experience where yep. we thought a specific keyword will have very low volume. No one we searched for, so we didn't really write about it. And then realized after talking to customer ourselves that actually everyone is mentioning this fucking thing, yet it doesn't seem like there's any volume for it. And we wrote about it and we got, you know, a lot of traffic. Very much like this podcast, you know, if I had looked at SEO stuff around marketing podcasts, I wouldn't have found any evidence that people wanted a marketing podcast without the bullshit. You know?
Yeah. But I think it's really important to be, you really have to be thoughtful about what metrics you're going to measure content with. You know, like, I think that really speaks to that point, you know, because if you can't, like, you know, certainly in the early days of a content program, you should just be able to see it's working. You should just, if you have to go and dive into the metrics, if we had to go and dive into the metrics in the first year at Intercom when I'd taken over the content program, there was something wrong. Because it should just be blatantly obvious that it's heading in the right direction. It shouldn't have to be like, oh, we're like ranking, you know, number one for, you know, these keywords on, you know, that show high intent for our software. I think obviously as you build it out and as you are, you know, develop that muscle of creating quality content, you can start to think about those very specific metrics and areas you want to grow in. And like, for instance, it's only maybe like in the last 18 months that we've really got focused on SEO and thought about like, how do we really, really harness SEO? Even though, you know, I've been at Intercom for nearly 6 years at this stage. So, you know, early on, it was really about just building that muscle of learning how to create quality content. And, you know, as you said, like, content marketers or marketers generally can be a little bit conservative and kind of sit in their own bubble and maybe aren't going and interviewing the CEO or the people. Like, our whole thing was nobody really cares, like, much as you say everyone hates marketers, no one cares what marketers think. That's our big belief. Like, they don't want to hear from the content team at Intercom. They want to hear from the subject matter experts. So if we are writing about design, there will be a designer's byline on there. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that that designer sat down and wrote 1,200 words, but they certainly worked with my team to come up with 1,200 words that they were happy putting their name to. So that might mean, you know, we end up interviewing that person and ghostwriting it for them. It might mean that we sit there with a whiteboard and like literally, you know, come up with an outline for an article and then they go off and draft it. It depends. You know, some people are great writers. Some people are just like really, really good subject matter experts who have great ideas, but they're not necessarily great writers at sharing them. But, you know, as I say, get the subject matter experts, because no one really cares what marketers think. It's much better off. Get out of your own bubble and get their opinions into your content.
Yeah, and it's tough for marketers to hear, but no one gives a shit about us, you know? They care about themselves, they care about the problem they want to solve, and they certainly care about listening from all their peers who suffer from the same problem or whatnot, but they don't really care about the opinion of a marketer about design and that kind of stuff.
If you're selling a content marketing product, you're quids in, you know, they want to hear about it. But otherwise, zip.
So let's go back to the first step, right? Which is about finding out those three things, you know, that are controversial, that your company agree with, that most people would disagree with. Just give me the example of Intercom. What is the one thing that you believe that most people don't?
Well, so I think like a good example I always give, just there's kind of two things here that we're kind of covering. One is this like focus on the quality content, but then and be like opinionated. I think like opinionated quality content is really, really important. But it's easy to get it wrong. And the way I say that, you like don't just create kind of like angry or contrarian content, which, you know, just like you get a reputation in your industry, is making sure that you stay brand relevant. And the way we do that at Intercom is we see the world through the sort of the lens of our product. And one of the big beliefs in our product is you should never send the same message to everyone in your customer base. Like you should literally, probably the only message that you want to send to everyone in your customer base, the exact same message is, hey, really sorry, didn't work out, we're shutting down the service. Like, you know what I mean? Like you send the right message to the right people at the right time. Like effective, that's what effective messaging is. And it's never going to be a one size fits all thing. So that is literally the thesis that like we have written probably about 20 blog posts, you know, broadly in this customer engagement sort of bucket about like targeted messaging strategies, how to write good messages, how to make messages relevant to people at the right time. And then that all rolled up into a book called Intercom and Customer Engagement. We have done microsites on the history of like messaging and customer engagement and how people have like customers and businesses have interacted. You know, that right message, right time, right place belief, which, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say it's something that no one else in the industry believes in, but we've really given it our take on that and really, I suppose, put our mark on it. We did have one post, which I was kind of on the fence of, which caused a bit of controversy, but we did the whole growth hacking is bullshit post with our original director of growth. And, you know, definitely on the fence as to maybe that was just a little bit too sort of trying to wind people up. But I think at the time, it was warranted because I think there was, you know, it was maybe at the peak of growth hackers as a community, and just some people just assumed, you know, that if you changed the button colors, you were like going to be on the, you know, you're going to be the next Stripe or whatever. And like, we all know that's like patently not the case.
So you find out the two to three things that are like controversial about you, or at least that you really strongly believe. You talk to the CEO, you talk to customers, you go meet them face to face at trade shows. And you put a name, you put a face. What I like about talking to customers is that you actually put a face to the people you want to talk to, and they will share with you stuff. They will share with you their problems and whatnot. Yep. Now, the next step, usually the hurdle is, as you mentioned rightly with your blog post around growth hacking is bullshit, you said there was some controversy. I suppose that internally some people didn't want that to be published, right? Or at least to be diluted down to maybe something a bit softer. How do you, when you start specifically a content program, as a marketer, like in charge of it, how do you convince people around you that, yes, we need to publish those type of posts? We need to take a stand. We need to show what we're made of.
So I would say the big thing you rely on in the early days, in which we relied on, is people's egos. So let me explain that a little bit. But like, first off, people get a buzz out of being published. Like it's a little bit scary, but you know, you're putting them out there into the world and then they start to get feedback. So you know, you want to make sure you are closing all those loops, that they are getting that feedback. So, you know, you're like, you know, particularly when maybe I'm just thinking of some examples from the early days of Intercom, but, you know, like our director of brand design or our director of product design will sit down, write a post. It's you know, it's probably going to be close to a day, at least a day's worth of work for him or her. And then they like put it out into the world and like they hear nothing. That's terrible. You know, you want to be pinging them, saying, hey, did you see like, you know, this designer over at Google shares your post on Twitter. You want to be like celebrating that in your general channel on Slack, you know, or whatever, wherever your company hangs out, that you can kind of go, hey, look at this amazing post that Emmett wrote and look at all this feedback it got. So like, make sure like that you celebrate all those successes really, really successfully or really, really openly internally. Another thing that worked really well for us at Intercom was to show that like actually creating content, you know, it's not just a, hey, I wrote a blog post, but hey, I wrote a blog post. And then, you know, maybe I like spoke at one of our meetup events. And from that meetup event, I got an invite to go and speak at a conference. And we made that really clear and sort of show those connections for people in the company. So people could see that actually, you know, writing a blog post is not something I'm just going to do in the evening. I'm going to go to my manager and I'm going to ask, can I make it one of my goals for this quarter? And then, you know, luckily at Intercom, because it came from the top, people would agree to that. But people could see that it was like, it was a good investment of their time for the company, but also for themselves. And then there's just little fun things you can do. Like, again, going back to people's ego, but just, you know, we used to publish a monthly league table of like who the most popular authors were on the blog. And, you know, if you can get your like VP of product and your VP of marketing kind of like literally openly competing with each other and saying, hey, I'm going to write a more popular post than you next month. You know, you're pretty home and hosed at that stage. And I think that it's all about like sort of making sure people see that this is not just ticking a box, that it's actually, you know, moving the needle for personal growth, for career development, and it moves the needle for the company as well. Make sure that you also like just show people that like, hey, we got X amount of leads from this activity that we did with content, this book we launched, or, you know, this guide we published. Really, really important just to close the loop there.
That's really interesting. And yeah, playing people's ego, having this leaderboard, showing them the path that it could take them on, this growth path of publishing a blog post, repurposing that into a slide, like slideshow, getting invited for bigger stuff. Now, that doesn't answer the question originally of, that's all well and good, but maybe most of those people writing could very be writing about vanilla stuff that no one really disagree with. So in the first place of this program, when you're only getting started, you mentioned about the, you know, the topics that are a bit controversial. How do you convince people to take the risk of doing so? Like this, those first few blog posts, those first few podcast episodes, those first few things that are quite risky.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's a tough one. All right, you've got to like try and find that champion inside. And I mean, I would say like that at Intercom, you know, I was not there at that time. It was Des Traynor, you know, and Des, I think he had seen just like, you know, elsewhere in the industry that it works. You know, like both himself and Owen very early on would have seen like people like HubSpot and seen that, wow, there's like, these people are opening up a whole new channel of leads by doing content. And so I think, you know, they didn't have to convince themselves, they saw it, but I think that's how you kind of maybe convince people that this is the way to go. You have to show them other successes, like whether it's peers or other industries and show like what it can do for your business. But, you know, I think that the stakes are even probably higher now than like 7 or 8 years ago, because, you know, with cancel culture and all that, you know, you're only as good as your worst piece. You know, it used to be a case that people would go, oh, I love the Intercom blog, there's always good stuff there. But like, you know, like most things on the internet these days, now we're kind of judged by our crappiest piece. You know, if we do something bad, that's what we'd be judged at. And so, you know, people will very quickly stop being readers if they come along and there's like, oh, I don't really like that stuff. You know, they've started writing about, you know, topics I'm less interested in or whatever. So you, particularly early on, I think the stakes are really high, that you've got to come out the blocks pretty strong, you know, with something that's going to, you know, not just grab attention in a very, I suppose, you know, sensationalist way, but that's just going to stand up to scrutiny, and that I think people are going to like want to share. You know, that's the other great thing about quality content. People do want to be seen sharing good quality content on social or wherever. So, yeah, and don't rush it, I think, as well. You know, a big thing we've seen, and we kind of touched on this already, is this idea of like people, you know, setting up some kind of content program, whether it's a blog or a podcast, and kind of like having these crazy, like, oh, we're going to do one every week. But actually, why not like do it every month and do 12 over a year? And like, they'll be much more considered, and you know, you'd have time to build up maybe search traffic, etc., versus like, you know, one a week for 12 weeks and then you run out of steam because it's just become a grind and a slog to actually get that out every week. And I think you talked about that recently on the show with Hilary Weiss, this whole idea of like shipping consistently and constantly. I mean, it's great to get that feedback, but you also have to make sure you're, you know, you have a realistic cadence. And yeah, even at Intercom, like we would very much believe in that, you know, that just constantly pushing it out there is not going to work.
Yeah. So one thing that I think is important here is, and something I used to think is, yeah, let's take our time to publish this piece and then let's take our time to publish this next piece. I believe that if you don't have some sort of consistency, even if it's every month, you tend to like put it off. You don't have necessarily a deadline to work towards, and you are as good as well as the feedback you're getting. So sometimes it's the balance between making sure you ship something so you get actual feedback instead of just keeping it internally like an idiot and shipping too fast. Because and then it becomes shitty, right? So you talked about it a few minutes ago. You talked about this idea of having a spark, which I very much like. So let's say you contact this designer inside Intercom who has something to say, right? Let's say they have something to say, and okay, that's cool. Like, what is the decision making, the process there to make sure there is a spark there, to make sure that this content will be shared and it's not going to be yet another cookie cutter type of content? Like, how exactly are you going through this to make sure that it stands out?
Well, for us, it's very much a case of like looking at like what else has been published on the topic. We very much involve people's, like, you know, like, say it's a designer, they would like get feedback from, we would say like get feedback from your team. So like there would be engineers, there'd be product managers on their team. Like, what do they think about this? Like, do they worked on the project with you. Do they find it's interesting? Like, bring it to the other designers. Just the same way that there'd be like reviews of your design work. Like, bring your post as well, and like ask people to give input that way. And I mean, I think we would apply the same sort of editorial kind of standards and processes that you'd get pretty much at any publication. Like, we, most of my like first few hires at, on the content team were all like editors who'd worked in traditional publications. And so it's a lot of just applying those kind of same editorial standards to what we do at Intercom. And there's been plenty of stuff that just didn't see the light of day over the years. Like, no one saw the stuff that we can and just said, hey, we're not going to do that. And another thing that I think is really, really important is just like trying to put yourself in your customer's shoes. Like, we do share a lot about, like, you know, what we've done at Intercom and what we've learned from our projects. But you always try and figure out like what's relatable from that. Like, how can someone else benefit from this? I remember like there was a post a few years back, Gustav's, one of our senior designers, wrote, which was about like why we chose folders rather than tags for like to organize messages in the product. And you know, at the time, I think like tags were quite like, I suppose, a bit more trendy in the design product world than folders. We went with folders. And like, you think about that could have been quite a boring, very specific post about a product decision at Intercom. But actually, we then said, okay, like, let's lift this up a layer and like think about like what about that decision-making process that Intercom went through could our customers benefit from? Like, what could they learn from? Like, what could be relatable for their, like, if they're in a similar position? And so it was actually quite a positive, like quite a popular post. But just as easily, as I say, could have been like quite an obscure sort of like, okay, this is the decision making process we went through. And as I say, just thought about like what could our customers and potential customers find of use from this process that we went through.
So you have the Spark, and you mentioned these editorial guidelines and the fact that it's pretty natural for you. You have more than 20 years experience in the space about it. You've hired editors as well. But how does it actually look like in detail? Like, what is the step by step editorial process that you have in Intercom to make sure that you actually publish those content that stands out? Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, so I mean, people pitch ideas to us. The actual pitch ideas to the content team. They can email them to us. We have office hours. They bring them to us, and like we will discuss them as a team sometimes, or like we'll get them to discuss them with their team. Like, it really is very much almost this like peer review process, I think, which is really, really important. That like, it's not just like, I've found the posts that have been least successful sometimes when we like look back on it, it's like there hasn't been that sort of like input from a bunch of people. And it's kind of been like one person's view of something we've done, rather than like the collective knowledge or the collective insight of people from around the company in that discipline. But then it just, like, I suppose, very practically in terms of like the process itself, once we've like decided, yeah, this is a good idea, there's just a bunch of things, I suppose, that are like quite standard in publishing industry. Like, so there's always two editors see everything and like input into everything. So it's never just one editor works with someone. So you always get that second set of eyes and stuff. I think just simple things like just making sure, you know, occasionally, obviously there's typos and stuff, but just making sure like that it's as good quality as we can actually what goes out. Cause I think that makes a huge difference, that, you know, if something's too long or if it's, you know, not short, you know, it's too short that you haven't explored something fully. Just even like simple things like breaking up articles with like quotes and images and stuff, like all the kind of common stuff that a publication would do. And I think that's sometimes what makes things stand out, because we see a lot of content, it does feel rushed out, and it kind of feels like, you know, it hasn't gone through a good editorial process, you know. And we all do that as well, where we find these articles, topics really interesting, but you find yourself skim reading it, because I think largely it hasn't gone through a good editorial process.
So you have this massive advantage at Intercom that people actually pitch stuff to you, right? So internally, you have hundreds at this stage of people actually have ideas and shit to share. And I mean, this is incredible, right? And it starts, as you said, from the very top, right? So your CEO from the very start of the company decided that it was part of the culture. How do you advise people who are in a company where the culture, this wasn't part of the culture, to start actually having that in the culture, having employees pitching ideas when it's not really something they're used to, you know, how do you convince them to do that? How do you set that up from scratch, really?
Yeah, I think it goes back to all the things I talked about earlier in terms of, like, you know, getting a couple of quick wins and then really, really, like, celebrating them. It's like supporting people through the process. Huge thing is, like, actually, you know, when we had, like, early on, I made sure that, like, people who, like, maybe, you know, as I'd say, like, our more difficult customers who needed maybe a lot of, like, handholding to get something out, but, like, hey, go and tell the rest of your team that, like, this is what we do and how we support you. Like, and to this day, you know, we still have to, like, kind of do our internal PR that people know what they're going to get if they engage with the content team, that they are going to get handheld through. And I'm constantly sort of, like, keeping my eyes out and I, like, encourage the team to as well, internally looking for things that we know could become good content. So it's like, you know, I even see, like, people on Twitter kind of sharing something and I'd be like, hey, did you spoke at that event? That talk looks really good. Why aren't you creating a blog post? You know, like, just constantly having this sort of spidey sense of, like, what are we creating already that could become content that we could share with the broader world? There's a lot of stuff that gets created internally in companies that, like, really could be shared. And I think it's just sometimes people, you know, a lot of people still have that mentality of, like, you know, sort of information has value, like, in and of itself. And it doesn't really. It's all about execution. You know, like, some of our most popular posts are, like, actually one post which has been hugely popular and continues to be hugely popular was Paul Adams, our SVP of product, literally wrote a post about our whole product building process from beginning to end. Like, what does a week at Intercom look like in terms of, like, the rhythm of the week, the meetings we have, like, how the product team create the roadmap, the tools they use. And, like, it really went in depth. And a lot of people were like, oh my God, like, why did you guys write that? Why did you share it? Presumably you're, like, giving an advantage to your competitors. And it's like, well, not really, because, you know, they've still got to execute against it. And it, like, the ideas are not in and of itself what's going to make you work. And actually, you know, by the time it's on the blog, and, like, this is a kind of a bit of an internal joke we have sometimes, is, like, you know, by the time we've gone through the process and written the blog post, those processes are already changing and tweaking and the company's just, like, grown a bit more and, like, some of that stuff's broken. So, like, if our competitors want to go and copy that old shit, great. You know, you know, they don't have the full context of like, how we use it or, like, you know, what the pros and cons of all those things are.
But it's like a chef afraid of sharing his recipes and afraid of writing a cookbook. Most of the time, I mean, most popular chefs have written so many fucking cooking book. They know that what matters is the execution and maybe a bit of the ingredients as well, the quality of the ingredients. So if you're afraid of sharing information, obviously we're not talking about proprietary, like, information that are, like, you know, related to your technology and whatnot, but the rest you should be okay to share it. And as you said, it's all about execution. So apart from the stuff you shared so far to actually build a successful content program, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think that the one other sort of piece of the strategy at Intercom that I always try and impress on people is this idea that we have, like, an evergreen content strategy, which I think is, you know, it's been anyone who's kind of looked at content marketing these days has probably heard of evergreen, but just this idea of, like, trying to write about stuff that, you know, is going to, like, it's a recurring problem that people have or a recurring issue that people are going to be, like, interested in. And rather than, like, trying to, like, do this kind of news jacking or, like, you know, writing about, you know, news events, which will have a huge amount of, like, so my background, obviously, I worked in news and newspapers in Ireland and, like, news websites and stuff. And, like, you know, news is incredibly spiky. You know, you'll get, like, day one, you know, you'll get 1,000 views for something, but day two, there'll be, like, 2 views, like, literally 2, like, no one is interested in old news. And so that's, like, people are attracted by the 1,000 figure, but they don't realize that actually the half-life of that content is nothing. You know, like, if I write, you know, 10 gifts for product managers this Christmas, you know, January 1st, it's not getting any traffic. And it's probably, you know, there's probably a 2-week window during the year when it gets traffic. Whereas with Evergreen, you know, you can actually do the same amount of work in terms of, like, produce the same amount of articles, but the traffic will work out much better. Thomas Tungas, you know, the venture capitalist with Redpoint, he writes on sales and marketing quite a bit. He wrote a great post a few years ago about the economics of an evergreen strategy. And he literally looked at like news articles versus evergreen articles, both getting the same, like publishing in the same cadence, 100 page views for each article on the first day for the news article and the evergreen article. But like after a year, when you run the figures, because the evergreen content doesn't decay as quickly, because it gets page views weeks and months after it's published, that you like 3x the traffic from an evergreen strategy. And that's absolutely been our experience. I mean, that post I talked about that Paul Adams wrote about how we ship software, that continues to get like a couple of hundred page views a month, even now. And it's like probably four years old at this stage. So I think, you know, that's how you make sure, like, investments in content are expensive, like, because a large part of it is you're either hiring like people like me, or you're like going to like marketing, content marketing agency, or, you know, like hiring free contractors. Like, content will not be cheap. It takes time to spin up. But if you go down the evergreen route, it will continue to pay off. It's, as I said, it's very different to other forms of marketing in that regard. Like, once you, when, you know, you can stop investing in new stuff, but the old stuff will continue to deliver for you. And I think that's, I don't know any other type of marketing that you can say that about.
Yeah, and in fact, this podcast is also an example of evergreen content. All of the episodes, I'm trying to make sure I never mention anything that is related to like news or whatever. And that all episodes can still be listened to today, it still be relevant. And that's exactly the strategy. So thanks for mentioning that. I should have also asked you that. But yes, evergreen all the way. What are the problems that people suffer from, that will still suffer from in, you know, 5, 10 years, 50 years? And in fact, the good segue into the next thing I wanted to ask you, John. And by the way, thanks for going through all of that and sharing your knowledge and the mistake you made, lesson you learned. What do you think marketers should learn today that will help them in the next 5 years, 10 years, 50 years?
I think just be very open-minded and be very, just like having that growth mindset. I know it sounds a bit of a cliche, but it's hard to know what will and will not, you know, sort of land in terms of like very specific tactics or trends or technologies. But I do think like just having that open-minded growth sort of mindset is the key. You know, as I said, I worked in media for 20 years, and actually I think like the media industry is so sort of battered and you know, having to produce more and more with less and less resources, that, you know, it's quite hard to have that kind of mindset. And what I love about like having made the transition to like what was a startup but is now like a kind of a like a scaling software company, is that like you constantly get to try new things and learn new things and do new things. You know, 2015 we launched a branded podcast. It was like, let's do 10 episodes and just see, you know, has anyone any interest in a podcast from a brand, because like there wasn't that many people doing it at the time. And guess what? They did. And so we doubled down and invested in that. And so, like, you know, I think it's just having that like experimental mindset and openness to new things, and like really just figuring out, like, going where your audience is. Cause like, you know, that's what the podcast was all about for us. It was like, actually, it's a very similar kind of content to what we say do in our blog or in our books or guides, but it's actually just tweaking it so it can be consumed in that format. And so people can listen to it, you know, when they're commuting or at the gym or wherever it might be. So that's, I think that's huge. I think it'll be even bigger for people as we move forward. Like the playbooks, old playbooks don't work anymore. And I think the like tactics get recycled, like, you know, the length of period that they are effective for is getting less and less. Like you're constantly having to try and reinvent yourself and come up with new things.
Agreed. Thanks for sharing that. What are the top three resources you'd recommend listeners? So it could be anything from podcasts, books, conferences, software, whatever.
For marketers at the moment?
Yeah.
Top three resources. I mean, I'm pretty old school. I still, Twitter, I find, you know, I have my little lists in Twitter that I'll jump into for different topics and just see like what discussions are going on there. You know, am I allowed to mention rival podcasts?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
But I do enjoy the Growth TLDR.
How dare you?
I obviously enjoy Everyone Hates Marketers, but you know, there's just some very, very interesting stuff going on in marketing at the moment as well. So I try and like, I always try and like read some mainstream, you know, not tech industry focused stuff. So things like The Drum, which is great just to find out generally what's going on in marketing beyond this sort of like, you know, world of tech and SaaS that I'm very much in, and trying like, I think that's where a lot of the spark ideas come from, like seeing what people are doing in other sectors and getting a sense of that.
And you waited 53 minutes to say that, right? To me, that's also a key point, right? Like, get out of your own bubble. All of the tools built out there, like social media tools, are there to make sure that you stay in the bubble. Fuck that. Let's try to get out of it actively. I personally like to go to subreddits that I disagree with and just read the shit they write. Because actually, you see a mirror image of, like, it's the actual opposite point of view, and it makes sense as well. It's crazy when you start, like, really reaching out to people who you actually don't agree with from the start. So yeah, the Drum, there's plenty of publications that are outside of tech and SaaS. So if you're in tech and SaaS in particular, I think it's extremely, I'm not going to use the term incest because that's very bad, but it's like we are getting
insular.
In
insular, I think, is the word you're looking for.
Very, very insular type of culture. And yeah, get out of it. I would agree with you, John. So thanks so much for sharing all your wisdom with us today. It means a lot. Where can people, you know, connect with you and learn more from you?
Okay, so, well, I'm on LinkedIn, which is a great place if you just want to, like, connect there. I'm always happy to accept connections, but I am pretty active on Twitter, and I'm kind of an old school internet guy, so I'm JCJAYCEE001 on Twitter.
The first one. All right, John, once again, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Louis. It was great being on the show.
That's it for another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com. And this is the moment where I tell you to subscribe to our email list. So before you leave and go to another podcast or listen to another episode, I don't treat email lists the way people usually treat their email list. I really treat that as a one-to-one conversation. So I'm going to send you very short and personal emails every 2 weeks, I would say. I'll inform you of guests in advance. I'll share with you my numbers and how many listens we get. And I'll also ask you for your feedback in terms of the questions we can ask future guests. And perhaps I can also have you on the show someday. So don't be afraid to subscribe. I'm not going to spam you. And you can always unsubscribe for sure if you wish. The second thing we need from you is your harsh and honest feedback. We know that this show is not perfect yet, and we always can improve. So you can send us your email at feedback@everyonehatesmarketers.com. Good or bad, please feel free to send me an email. And the last thing I'd like from you is that if you did like the episode, please share it to your friends, your colleagues, or whoever might like it. And also please review it on iTunes or another service that you might use to listen to your podcast. Because if you leave us a 5-star review, it means that more people will be likely to listen and we can spread the word quicker. So thank you so much once again, and au revoir.